All right, guys, we are going to begin. All right. So we have our resident, my class called Virtual Breakfast, according to Hashem. We have discussed Virtual Breakfast, but it's something that has, it's a topic that keeps on giving. There's so much.
Oh, are we on Zoom?
I'll
work it. Can you have the link?
I think that's the same thing as also has the entire year. So it's also, you can check on the WhatsApp group. Fellowship. I posted like 20.
Okay.
I did, I don't know if I did, whatever.
Yeah.
Fine. All right, no idea. All right, so that's it. Spelled from a WhatsApp group called Senior Fellowship. So it's always amazing. Okay, so tonight we're gonna get into Herzl and Dreyfus, which we discussed. Those were last year. It's a different video. And I wasn't happy with, so I cut that one out. But this one's actually done by Christian
Broadcasting.
It's CNN. They did it.
Well, they have good stuff.
They have a good job, you know? I don't care. If they deliver the good, I'm all good with that. Here we go, guys. Hit the lights.
The journalist who became a dreamer. And Theodore Herzl has his aha moment. And the idea that became a nation. A beacon to humanity. We begin our series, The Hope, The Rebirth of Israel. I call it the Jujitsu Movement.
Where it's something that is returned to set positive. 700 Club Interactive. Well, welcome to 700 Club Interactive. In AD 70, the Romans conquered Jerusalem, and the
people were scattered throughout the world. But even in exile, they celebrated Passover each year with the prayer of hope. Next year in Jerusalem. Well, after more than 1,800 years, the dream of a Jewish homeland was stronger than ever. And in the late 19th century, a young writer from Vienna brought that dream to the attention of the world. In 1893, a Viennese journalist wrote, "When I think of my son's future, I ask myself whether I have the right to make life so difficult for him as it has become for me. That is why we must baptize Jewish children, while they can still feel nothing, either for it or against it. We Jews must submerge in the people."
In nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti.
It's not something you'd expect to hear from the man known as the father of Zionism. But those words were written by Theodor Herzl, who spent his life trying to solve what he called the Jewish question. Herzl was born in Budapest in 1860. At the time, the city was known as Judapest because of its large Jewish population. As a boy, he attended a Christian high school that was open to Jews. And on his 13th birthday, his parents held a confirmation ceremony instead of a bar mitzvah.
Theodor Herzl was an assimilated Jew who came from an assimilated family. He was not educated in the Jewish sphere at all. He was very, very far from Judaism.
His family later moved to Vienna, where Herzl earned a law degree, but his real passion was writing, so he divided his time between writing plays, working as a reporter, and looking for a way to end anti-Semitism.
Theodor Herzl is the one who sort of pulls it together, but there are many. There are Christian ministers, there are rabbis, there are all kinds, there are presidents, there are all kinds of people who are saying, wait a minute, we've got this problem.
At one point, Herzl even proposed a mass baptism of Jewish babies in Vienna's largest cathedral. He believed that if Jews adopted Christian culture, they would finally be accepted by European society. But Theodor Herzl was about to get an assignment that would change his mind.
It was as a journalist for the top newspaper in Vienna that he was sent to Paris. to write about the wonderful French experience. Herzl, who was a bon vivant, you know, and was living in Paris and enjoying himself and going to the theater three times a week, and all of a sudden, he saw the ugly face of antisemitism.
Herzl was assigned to cover the famous Dreyfus Affair, in which a French Jewish captain was falsely convicted of spying for the Germans. Herzl watched as Alfred Dreyfus was stripped of his medals and publicly degraded at the military school in Paris. Crowds filled the streets, shouting death to the Jews.
People are inflamed, and they're shouting, not down with Dreyfus, not down with the individual, they shout down with the Jews. And Theodor Herzl has his aha moment.
Herzl realized that the only solution to anti-Semitism was for the Jews to have their own state.
Wonderful idea. How do you go about doing it? This is where the writer of plays came in. You know, he was going to set the stage.
Herzl shut himself in his apartment and wrote his ideas down for five straight days. When a friend of his visited, he was alarmed by Herzl's disheveled appearance and wild ideas. He suggested they get some fresh air. And as they walked, he told Herzl to get some medical help before someone hauled him off to a madhouse. Herzl paid no attention, and the following year, he published his most famous work, The Jewish State.
Theodor Herzl, in his book, The Jewish State, dreams. And he talks about this new nation state being a beacon to humanity. He talks about it being a model democracy.
Not everyone was thrilled with Herzl's ideas. Religious Jews thought it was blasphemy to reestablish the nation of Israel without the Messiah. Nevertheless, Herzl worked tirelessly to realize his vision. He even tried to buy the land of Palestine.
He tried to create a situation where he will be introduced to the Sultan of Turkey and he will buy the land of Israel from him. Boy, that's going to cost a lot of money. How is he going to pay for it? Well, he had the dream. He had an idea. He says, I'm going to take half of the riches of all the rich Jews. Well, of course, there was absolutely no chance that any of these people would do that. They did not want to see Zionism succeed, in fact. But he was convinced that that's the way to do it.
In 1897, Herzl gathered Jewish delegates from around the world for the first World Zionist Congress. For this historic meeting, he chose the city of Basel in Switzerland.
By the way, do you know why it was in Basel? It was supposed to be in Munich. And in Munich, there were Jews who called themselves Germans of the faith of Moses. And they said to him, we don't want this Jewish riffraff from all over the world coming to Munich.
In August, more than 200 delegates from 17 countries arrived in Basel. It was the first representative Jewish assembly in nearly 2,000 years. And the atmosphere was electric. Behind the podium hung a white flag with two blue stripes and a Star of David, a version of the design that would be adopted by the State of Israel 50 years later. Among the delegates was a man Herzl introduced as the first Christian Zionist. The Reverend William Heckler was the British Embassy chaplain in Vienna. He was deeply interested in the return of the Jews to Israel. So he helped Herzl make some important political connections, and the two became lifelong friends. As Herzl walked to the podium, people cheered and stomped their feet. He opened the Congress by announcing, "We are here to lay the foundation stone of the house which is to shelter the Jewish nation." The applause was deafening. One English delegate described the excitement of the crowd. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept as we remembered Zion. By the rivers of Basel, we sat down
and resolved to weep no more.
The beautiful thing about Theodor Herzl and the beautiful thing about Zionism is that it doesn't just stop with the negative. There is anti-Semitism, and there is negativity, and there's a certain rejection on the part of Europe. But what they also do is, I call it the jujitsu move, where you take the negative and you turn it into something positive.
A few days later, Herzl made a bold statement in his diary.
At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be answered by universal laughter. Perhaps in 5 years, and certainly in 50, everyone will know it.
Herzl's statement turned...
All right, guys. I thought that was extremely well done. All right, so you guys, not on your Jewish modern Jewish history now. Casey with us? You're here. Casey, can you hear me? Let us begin.
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Let's just look quickly just to make sure you get a little comprehension. I got a sheet. Let's roll through this. Okay, what problem did Herzl want us off? Quick. On board. Yeah. Correct. Number two, what was his initial solution? No. Basically, if we have a problem of being viewed as the other within the European society, very simple. We will join European society, which and to be a member of Europe in the 1870s meant to be a good Christian. So we'll take all the babies to the main church in all the towns in of Europe and have them baptized before they know anything, and then they'll be Christian. No problem. There'll be no anti-Semitism. Solved. We're going to get back to that. We'll think of that. We'll keep that idea
in mind.
Wait,
are you saying that there would be no Jews or like, yeah, like Jewish, but like...
No, but there'll be anti... He, as he grew up, how did he grow up? Super secular. He's an assimilated person. Right, so all for him, he just wants to remove anti-Semitism. The way to remove anti-Semitism, he believed, his initial strategy was, we'll cease to be Jews. We'll just join the host culture. It's very logical. Okay? All right. Then, and of course, what does the initial solution show about the observance of Jews at the time of Herzl? Yeah, the Western Europe, as you should know, Western Europe, after the emancipation of Jewry, emancipation means they, two things, if no two words, emancipation and enlightenment. Emancipation is politically where they're now allowed to become citizens. Prior to the French Revolution, Jews were not citizens. They were centralized citizens in Europe. Okay, so it's emancipation, becoming. And then enlightenment was the belief of which are ideas which are going beyond ideas or truth which are conceived of beyond revelation.
There were no like Orthodox Jews in Herzl's like
neighborhood. There were.
Or like in a 20-mile radius.
There were, but they weren't. But the communities were very separate. I mean, just you should know when Shaul Shmuel Hirsch, who was a parliamentarian in Moravia, went to be the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, Germany, Frankfurt all name, there were less than 10 Shomri Shabbos. The reform movement who started in Germany was so powerful that basically in the major cities, not even the smaller towns, people had become reformed Jews and therefore had abandoned mitzvot. And he brought it back. And he's really, you can argue, one of the followers of modern Orthodox because he believed that he was an educated person, he was a parliamentarian, and he was, you know, Wikipedia master class because he's a fascinating character.
And he put forth the philosophy of Torah in Derech Eretz, Torah with Derech Eretz for a livelihood or a worldliness. Okay, so he's living simultaneously. They are two people living simultaneously. All right, we digress. Were the Jews at the time of Herzl and Dreyfus more or less observant than the Egyptian Jews? Going back to our topic. Less observant, more? Okay, why say same?
The Egyptians at the time weren't necessarily observant of Jewish laws. They were
Yes, they did idolatry. Yeah, basically the Jews, except for, in fact, the Midrash says, what was the only tribe that did not observe idolatrous during the slavery was the Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi. Everybody else, that's it. So everybody else basically had become so acculturated, so assimilated, they basically adopted the values of the culture, which is always the deal. The minority community will, by and large, it's a law of political science, will, in order to gain security, will adopt the ways, the values, the cultures of their host culture.
Yeah, but
that's it.
The Jews, at first time, they knew what Judaism was. They knew about rituals and culture. The Jews, at least, they didn't have anything really, aside from circumcision and monotheism.
That's not true. There was a whole... In other words, to be a follower of Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, which was a family tradition at this point, not a national tradition, meant very distinct values. It did not have a lot of, you see that Avraham, without an obligation, did Hashanah as orphan. You see, it did not have the same structure that we have as, in other words, in the pre-mitzvah era, it was more of a philosophical, non-structural legal approach. But they were very different because they were called the Ivrim,
right.
The Hebrews, and in fact, it says that what did the Egyptians not like to do with the Ivrim? The Pasuk says it openly. In the time of Joseph, brothers come down, invited in. And then literally there are three tables. There's Yosef because he's the viceroy, so he's eating by himself. The brothers are eating at another table. And the Egyptian staff are eating at another table. Why? Because it was an abomination to eat for the Jews. Uncleus says why? Because the Jews would eat the lambs, which were viewed as part of their caste of gods. One fear. In other words, they were viewed as being not religious. It's funny, in other words, if you saw an Abrahamic person or a follower of Abraham, he comes across as being not religious because he's not pagan. So he's not doing all the superstitious rituals and he's eating their gods. He's enjoying a lamb chop, okay? He has other weird things, so they look down upon because he's doing something. The Jew has always been different.
But the Jews in Egypt, they were also in place. They didn't have the luxury of assimilation or of abandoning or choosing not to observe.
It's interesting, but we're going to get into that. First of all, as we discussed a month or so ago, we talked about, remember, they came to Egypt initially as invited aristocrat guests. They became a large population. There was a level of, they may not have intermarried, but they became Egyptian-like in dress and in culture and even beliefs. So it may not have been marrying to Egyptians, but they were fundamentally Egyptian in so many ways. So I don't know if you caught that line. They're supposed to have the first Zionist con in Munich. And why did they not have it in Munich? The Jews, who are, we are Germans of the Mosaic persuasion, do not want these people, what do they want to be? I'm German with a little sprinkle of Jewish culture. And these guys are trying to do what? Now why is that? But they call riffraff, but let's go a little deeper. I'm asking you, what is, now, you could argue, you look at Herzl, he's not an observant Jew.
He's dressed like
a very distinguished. He has a nice beard. Got the best beard. The best beard.
Well, I wish I could rock that beard.
Right. So, but he's not an artist. He's a very refined European person. He goes to the theater. In every way, he's like that. But why do they call him Riff Raff?
He's not, Jewish.
Yes. Go on deeper. Yes, correct. But more, yes. In what way do they find that? Why do they find the for example, the Reform movement, as you should know, do not adopt Zionism as a good until the 60s?
But they didn't need
it. Why do they find that such an, why would the secular Jews, the German Jews of the Mosaic persuasion, find that belief so antithetical that they have to dismiss them as being riffraff?
So what happened with the Reform movement is that for the
okay, so I hear you, but you're very soft. Hold on one second. Let me crank you up here. Let me crank you up. Again.
So what happened with the Reform tradition was, what happened in the Reform tradition? Can you hear me?
I pumped your volume.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm here. I'm talking.
Daisy?
Yeah, can you hear me? I've done nothing different. Are you sure you didn't mute me?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
The land of Israel is biblical.
Yes.
And so the idea of going back to Zion is rooted in religion.
Yes.
And that's the Zionists say that.
Why not?
They
went to shul.
But they weren't very happy living in Germany. Like, they had no need or desire to have to find a new homeland because that was their
home. It makes them a minority state. Like, Germany's not awesome.
Correct.
Israeli in Israel.
Right.
The Pan-African. He's just shining light on the truth that they makes them minority.
If they say that Israel is our homeland, even if I'm completely not observed in every way, I don't keep Shabbat or kosher, that basically means what? I am breaking from Germany. You can't be a good German and say your homeland is Israel. I don't care what you do. That's it. Even Herzl did not view it because he's doing it for biblical reasons. He didn't really know. And what was his famous possibility of considering the homeland? Anybody know? Uganda. There you go. Okay. Yes. Uganda. Okay. Question. All right. Keep on. This is just getting you guys up. I'm just warming you guys up, even though it's very warm here. Why was Herzl at the trial of Dreyfus? John Simon. Boom. Question six. What nationality did Herzl have? Dreyfus. Why was Dreyfus' nationality particularly significant? Earth? Let's go. Get open the door. I am. So he's Austro-Hungarian. Well, he's born in Budapest, Hungary. Yeah. Good. Okay. And Dreyfus, of course, French.
Yeah.
Great. Why is Dreyfus' nationality fairly significant to Herzl? They were the stars of the French Revolution. They're the stars of emancipation and the Enlightenment. And lo and behold, even this guy's accused of being what? They immediately went to the anti-Semitism. But basically, he saw what truth did he see as a reality?
Well, it's not even that he's in France. That is a military guy.
Right.
So he's the most assimilated and most faithful to the state kind of guy. It's impossible to be more assimilated than Brexit.
Right, and more patriotic.
And more patriotic.
Right.
Impossible.
Well, they claim that he was a spy, that he was involved in espionage, whatever, but now obviously he was framed, it came out later. But what was the epiphany to say?
No,
no amount of intellect is needed.
Yes, so, you know, that assimilation was the way to get rid of antisemitism.
And then?
And you take the song that was one of the best places in the world to be assimilated.
Yep.
You take a military guy.
Right.
It's impossible to be more assimilated than Dreyfus.
Yes.
And it's a failure.
And so what truth did he see? What he had an epiphany. What reality did become clear to Herzl?
No answer would be found in Europe.
No amount of assimilation.
Correct. Assimilation is not a solution to the Jewish problem. Now I'm gonna shift a little bit. I'm gonna focus upon. I'm going to skip, go to 11, and we're going to go back to 8, 9, 10 for a moment. In what way is intermarriage today the same program as Herzl's conversion to Christianity?
It's all very convenient, you know. It puts practical secular comfort above, the hassle of being religious in a world where you don't have to be, where it's very easy not to be. It's preferable almost.
Yes, that would probably be not religious. So what is it? How is it, in what way is intermarriage today the same problem as Herzl's conversion to Christianity plan? 71% of non-Orthodox Jews intermarry.
It's so casual. Like, people don't even realize. They don't know how important it is. They don't know how important, what a big deal that is.
I understand that, but I'm just saying that, but I'm just saying it's not, I'm not saying it's identical. I'm saying there's a similarity. What is the similarity?
They want to be more American. They want to be more Canadian or French or whatever it is. Way of them, like, becoming more normalized in society.
Right. Back in Herzl's time, to become a part of Europe, the only way in was to become converted to Christianity.
But I think what he's also
saying, here, now, conversion to Christianity is a negative, because religion generally is on the decline. What is the thing is where there is no different, where religion is not a factor. So basically, I become American by marrying another American or a Canadian or a French person. That's it. So fundamentally, it's the same thing, just to become comfortable and not, and to, you know, and where my Judaism is not really a problem. Now, So it's ironically, it's the same thing. We're going to circle back to that later in the class. What statement about anti-Semitism in the Seder did Herzl and the Zionist movement generally awaken to? In every generation they rise to destroy us, and the whole one blessed be he, come to rescue us. Now, he recognized that we could be the most polite, civically minded, law-abiding, Frenchman, German, Austrian, it makes no damn difference. Because when there's a problem and they need the Jew, we'll be there. And of course, the reality of the last couple months has shown that. And we'll see how it's going to go. I don't think it's going to get better. Question 10. How do you think Herzl felt about his previous fantasy-based conference in European society? He had prior to be awoken by the breakfast of trial. What mitzvah is this awakening part of? No. No, it was part one. What do you think Herzl felt about his previous fantasy-based conference in European society? He had prior to be awoken by breakfast trial. That's right. How do you feel about his, what did he feel about his society before the crisis? Just simply.
France was against liberté, égalité, fraternité, which means complete equality between citizens.
Yeah.
And even this society failed, and so we realized it also.
So, but that realizing that you're wrong actually is a mitzvah. What mitzvah did he? What he? There's a big mitzvah that he was involved in. Teshuva. He had the chait. He had the sin that he believed that he is European. He is I'm essentially a goy.
Didn't the video we watched last year show that the family, like right after
something?
Is that a video
about someone else? That's different from someone else. That's Franz Rosenzweig. It's Franz Rosenzweig. He's a similar kind of guy. Franz Rosenzweig is a guy.
But it was still related.
No, Franz Rosenzweig was Herzl-esque in the same way. He was completely secular, and then his friend was related. The connection, excellent point. In other words, Franz Rosenzweig's friend from university said to him, well, you should, you know, you're not, why are you being Jewish? You're not, you're Christian every way. Just be, you know, either put up or shut up. If you're going to be Christian, step up to the plate and do it right. None of this walk Christian, talk Christian, dress Christian, observe the holidays in sort of like a quasi fan. Just step up and be, do it right, convert. And then you had the whole epiphany. That was our pre-Yom Kippur. Okay, now let's get into some of the psukim, critical psukim here, where we have the inflection point of the Jews are enslaved basically for about other 210 years in Egypt. About 110 years they are being abused in slavery. Then we get to verse 23. Let's have somebody read. Go ahead, Jonathan.
A new question. A long time then passed, and the king of Egypt died. The Israelites were still groaning because of their subjugation. When they cried out because of their slavery, their pleas went out before God. God heard their groans, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the Israelites, and Hashem related.
Right, but Yeda, and he knew. I mean, so.
Oh, he related.
All right, that's okay, good. Now, let's see how the Avram and Rambam, we only have one. The Rambam's son, Avram, wrote a commentary on the Chumash. We only have one manuscript, which is in the Huntington, which is in Oxford, which is only a manuscript that covers Bereishit and Shemot, and was lost, you know, through the ravages of time. And this is, we have some comments from him. So, and what's interesting about his commentary is that you get, his father died, I think, when he was, I think, 18. But he was still, he was taught, he was from the second marriage, Avram, the Rambam's first wife died, and the Rambam's first children died. Remember, in the Middle Ages, even though he was a doctor, no modern medicine, you know, infant mortality was, and mortality in general was high. In fact, the Rambam lived to 67, 68, so was himself remarkable for his time. Let's go on. They groaned.
They groaned. They were in pain and sad because of the great difficulty of slavery. This was intensified because after the wicked king died, another wicked king took his place. There was no salvation or respite from the oppression. They cried out. This crying refers to Zaka form of cry out to Tula, to the God. It was if they grabbed an opportune time after the death of the king and received a little respite in their labors that they used to gather to pray as a king. They groaned. Deathly groans, as in the type that one hears when people are crying from intense pain. Their prayers were accepted, as the verse in Psalm says, a broken and contrite heart, God, you will not despise.
Okay. In what way, let's put it all together, in what way did the Jews in Egypt share the same hate of Herzl? In other words, they had their big breakdown. I'll put in another I'll go to question 13, then a little hint. Go to question 13. What did the Jews imagine would happen after the first Paro died? They would be free, or there'd be a reduction of the slavery. This guy who's enslaving us, he's a tyrant. He's a madman. He doesn't appreciate us. I don't know how great that we are law abiding, good Egyptians who want nothing but the betterment of the state of Egypt. And this guy's a nutcase that has something out for the Jews. So what we're going to do, we're going to, as many Jews have done throughout the ages, is to wait out the anti-Semitism. It'll pass. Sadly, many Jews in pre-World War II, as Hitler was coming to power, 33, 34, 35, 36, especially in Germany and around, he's a madman, he's crazy. The things he says he's going to do, he's not going to actually be able to do. We'll wait him out, and he'll get deposed. or he won't be able to accomplish his goals. And many Jews had that belief, and tragically, they were wrong, and they died. So they thought it was going to be better. He dies, and then a new king arrives. And what happens? What does King 2 do? Right, so he continues the program, and just you know, not, the change of administration does not a change of policy. And then they had the point where, so therefore, based upon that, going back to question number 12, in what way did the Jews in Egypt share the same fate, the sin of Herzl? It's a universal fate, universal sin. Trustworthy in what?
This time will be different.
But someone shows you that they're an anti-Semite, you should believe that they're
not. Well, they knew that he was an anti-Semite, but they felt that, okay, but the next one's going to be better.
But they can trust humanity,
okay. Yes.
That
we say, it's in the Siddur, we say it every day in the... to say that do not rely upon the authority who has no salvation. In other words, they believe in Paro. They believe in human kings. They believe that that these authorities are going to help them out. They believe in man. And a Jew has to know one thing. You don't trust a man. You don't trust a man. Any man. Let's fast forward. Rabbi Soloveitchik. We have to bring Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's just an obligation here. It's a great story. He felt when it was in the 60s. 50s and 60s. When classified information about the State Department and what was occurring during in the State Department during the Holocaust. When did they know? What was the response? And why did they not either do either, number two things, open the doors to immigration, or B, bomb the camps or the railway? Why did neither happen? And the only Jews, they had one rabbinic a protest. And Roosevelt would not even come out to meet them. He sent some lower person and said, "We'll take care of it. Don't you worry about it." And he says that. And by the way, this is for 1,000 points in the square. How many terms did Franklin Delano Roosevelt get elected to?
Four.
Correct. So American Jews look at Franklin Delano Roosevelt literally as the Messiah. He had brought America out, or if he was deemed bringing America out of the Depression, he's a Democrat, you know, and he would be a person who would, and he says he's gonna defeat Hitler and he's gonna save the Jews. We trust him. Mistake. It came out in the conversations with the State Department, which was wildly anti-Semitic, who had no problem with the fact that Jews are getting, remember, we're talking about a situation where they knew that in Auschwitz, you're talking about 16,000 Jews being killed, gassed and burnt per day. 16,000. So the people are like all the Jews and most of the Upper West Side being destroyed in a day or two. Well, you can't just understand the numbers here. They knew about this. They knew about this early in 41, certainly by 42. And for 3 years, nothing. And he says that's the fate. That's the fate. It's a universal fate. It's a very hard fate to get over. The Jews trusted in Paro. He's going to help us out. Herzl, we're going to join them. We'll even convert to their religion. They're going to help us out. Then a Dreyfus affair pulls away the grape. It's a lie. They'll sell us out. We cannot rely upon anybody else to protect us. And we rely on wisdom and Hashem. Nothing else. Doesn't mean that we are anarchists. Means that we just don't, but if you're going to base your hope that governments and authorities are going to bail you out, it's not true. And that is the Achilles heel of Jewish history. Okay? That is a seminal hate the Jew desires, the love of the Goy. And that's an assimilation. Jews get destroyed in two kinds of ways, either through bullets or kisses. and in America, we're being kissed all over.
Great shit.
Okay, but that is starting to change, right? It's changing to at a theater near you. Unfortunately.
Don't you see that happening now?
Yes, now. I'm 100%. Well, yes, we had a Parsha class 2 weeks ago. We talked about the Jews 3 weeks ago, self defense, and a Jew has to learn how to defend themselves, and what Jews and Jewish institutions should do. And that's the whole issue. To be continued. That's a whole topic in its own right. Now, 14. Where did we see the tshuva of Egyptian Jews? What were the elements of the tshuva? Yes. They cried to Hashem. Now, apparently, the fact that the Torah identified they cried to Hashem, you can make an inference that they were not crying out before. They went from being non-daveners to daveners. Well, they did cry to Pharaoh. The Torah talks about they complete the paro. You know, it's not fair that you're taking away our straw and you have to give the same quota. Yes, they went to propitiate and beg to paro, who was the deity.
But then in like the Haggadah, it says, right, they like cried out and God heard their prayers.
Yeah.
So after they cried out.
But only after they cried, in other words, they had an awareness that they had to see the bankruptcy of their worldview. They had to hit bottom. In other words, you only can start the 12-step program of being a recovering alcoholic or addict when you see that your strategies of life result in absolute failure and disaster. So at that point, they cried to Hashem because before that, they felt that their own wisdom could work it out. Their wisdom and working with the government, that's going to be the solution. And not so. There was an abandonment of in part, not completely, but at least there was a movement in that direction. And that's when they recognized that they cannot rely upon Paro for their future. Not going to happen. But for decades they did. Decades, they were under oppression for decades. This was the servitude that happened over many decades, many administrations. We don't know. It just says that Paro died and a new Paro came. So we don't know how many Paro. Paro is a generic term. We don't know. But that's the key thing. Now, what is Zaka? You're going back to our field classes. Why was Zaka crying out best prayer characterized their davening? Rav Ben Rama talks about that. What is a Zaka? In other words, in Judaism, we have many different phrases for prayer. Zaka is a certain kind of tefillah. Yeah, it's a cry. What's the cry? A Zaka is always a case of what kind of situation. Yes. Wow. So, what was they looking at? What were they facing? Absolute destruction. Right. Correct. In other words, there's going to be a genocide. That's going to happen on the 14th day of Adar. We're going to be led by the second ruling authority of the Persian Empire called Haman, and it's going to be game over. Jew people are going to. That's it. We're going to. It's all over. So Zaka is the cry. We'll get into the Ram momentarily. When you're at where you feel you are completely in a state of absolute catastrophe and calamity, and you need Hashem to provide some sort of help here, because we're not making it. Zaka is a tefillah cry, prayer of tefillah, when basically you feel you have no options. Okay, let's read the Rambam. If you would like to read it, let's go to Anna.
It is a positive Torah commandment to cry out, Zaka and found comfort in the event of any difficulty that arises with affects the community, as members of the United States, when you go out to war against an enemy who attacks you and you sound the trumpet. This commandment is not restricted to such a limited scope. Rather, the intent is, whenever you are distressed by difficulties, example, famine, plague, locusts, or the like, cry out to God because of them and sound the trumpet.
Good. So, why is Zaka type prayer a biblical commandment in times of trouble? In other words, is it biblical? Everybody agrees, even though there's a debate about daily prayer if it's biblical or not. The Rambam says yes, Nachman says no. Okay, but everybody agrees that when there's a time, when there's a catastrophe, it's an obligation. Rav Moshe actually goes, but it's an obligation. Rav Moshe finds and says, even though that the Ben Noach only has seven commandments. When it comes to if they're having a catastrophe, in other words, they're going through a, you know, they got a bad diagnosis and they're, you know, cancer situation, that even a non-Jew must daven. Why is that? So why is that? Let's explain that. Let's unpack that one. It's a very important concept here.
Because why is it a commandment? It seems almost like a natural thing that happens. Like you don't have to tell anyone if it's that dire, if even like, yeah, it's a little bit atheist. Or
That's true, but this is an obligation. So it applies to both. This is talking about initially. If there is a national catastrophe, that the nation has to be involved in national Zaka. And if it's a personal situation, it's going to be private Zaka. Okay? Okay, just to fast forward, we referenced, of course, the Six-Day War. Right at the Hamtana, which was two, three weeks of waiting prior to June 5th, 1967. When they're waiting, what's going to happen? Will the United States come to their aid? No. Will Europe come to their aid? No. Can rely on anybody else? No. And Lyndon B. Johnson, the president, said, if you shoot the first shot, we're not backing you up. And that was, and they had to make the decision, but they knew, but if we're going to respond, we're going to get crushed. We can only win through the act of surprise of doing the first shot. That's as the time for national, and truthfully, right, Krasansky shared when he was a little kid, he was a fourth grader during the time, and he said that there was no classes in yeshiva. You're in yeshiva, the ratings were on continuously. There was people actually doing fasts. They thought it was going to be a Holocaust. There's an obligation on the community to be involved in Zaka. And rabbinically, on top of that, even fasting. That is basically the time for tshuva. The tshuva-based tshuva. Now, why is it biblical? Because if you don't daven in that time, basically God's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Or if you, I believe there's a deity, but prayer has no thing. Basically, you're saying that God has unrelated to mankind, and that essentially denies the revelation that, or the essence of Judaism is that God has revealed to humanity that he is concerned about humanity. And he will listen to humanity. Which is, by the way, without revelation, you would not know that. So if you don't daven, you're basically saying that God's irrelevant. Either you're atheist, agnostic, or God's irrelevant. Pick your choice. If you don't daven then, it's a denial of God. Because if the time of catastrophe, you're not davening, what are you waiting for? If you think there's time for divine providence, when would you like divine providence? When you're dead? It's now.
But what about all the people that did this and nothing happened?
Zaka does not mean that tefillah, yes, right. There are people who are davening. So first of all, tragically, just because there is a phenomenon of tefillah does not mean that tefillah is always answered. And yeah, Jews who were in the trains going to Bergen-Belsen, who knew that they were going to be done, or stepping off and smelled the smoke of burning humans, they, I don't know if they had the presence of mind to eat whatever. Even if they did do that, doesn't mean that it's going to be accepted. Now, why is not accepted? I don't know.
You have to do it.
Now, it doesn't mean that you have to do that. You also have to figure out, in addition, you have a practical obligation to try to work out a way to do what you can to, in other words, we don't ask God to bail us out. We partner with Hashem. We have to do our best to solve the problem. But you need Hashem's help so that the problem, that your solution will be a helpful solution. Now, let's merge the previous class to this class. Using Nehemiah's prayer, how should the Egyptian Jews express their zakah? I don't know if you remember it by heart. I doubt you would, but I know that Shane's got the sheets. Shane's got the sheets. So, but what was the main motif? What was the main motif of Nehemiah's prayer when he heard that Jerusalem's in ruins in his tefillah? What was the basic element? I don't know the detail. What was the basic element of his prayer?
God created the world, God is the forefathers,
the covenants. Yes, good. And we've sinned, and we fundamentally have not accepted our part of the covenant. And we know that, but we want to, if we get another chance, we will improve. So that it would have to have those elements. In other words, Nehemiah expressed the Zaka prayer. That's the Zaka prayer. In other words, it's also a recognizing of that we're the Jewish people. If we're not aligned with the covenant, these things can happen to us. So basically, the fact that they had, what covenant did they abandon? Here's the question. What covenant did the Jews in Egypt abandon? There's no Torah yet. There's no covenant of Sinai yet. That's going to happen. The covenant with Abraham. That God relate to the Jewish people, but assuming that they are going to follow Abraham, the Abrahamic ideals. So they no longer do bris milah as a manifestation, but they're not really accepting the God of Abraham anymore. I'm an Egyptian. That's why Moshe had to recommand circumcision, because they stopped doing circumcision. But it's not about the cutting of the flesh. It's about what did they hold dear to them? What were their values? What do they teach their kids? Were they teaching them about Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Were they teaching them about monotheism? Were they teaching about being Adam L'chaver, or being ethically sensitive to every person? Or not? Or they absorbing the Egyptian culture of hedonism, of taking, you know, of tyranny and abusing people, slavery of the horror, most horrible fashion. And then, of course, we get to our last question of the night. How should we express our zaka to the threat of anti-Semitism? If we have to craft a prayer added to our Amidah, because we have said, we're just, all of us here know, we're just waiting for the shoe to drop. You're waiting for your phone to send a message, and some shul or some gathering of Jews, something horrible is happening. Either in America or in Europe, or God forbid, in Israel. Just, you know, I don't know, that's how I feel. I'm projecting. You guys, is that something that you feel? In other words, you should not expect, do you expect it should be a fundamentally different? In other words, do you expect that do you trust that the New York City police force has your back? First of all, they're not anti-Semitic, not state-run anti-Semitic, but they're not designed to deal with a minority that has the crosshairs on its back. They're not designed for that. You know what I'm saying? There may be 31,000 New York police officers, but they're not designed to provide a uniform cop in front of every shul, yeshiva, and synagogue. They just don't have the resources, even if they wanted to. The budgetary value is not that.
We as a community have an obligation.
Yes.
To secure our
own protection. Yes. 100%.
And so, by the way, and also lobby our legislators.
Yes.
So that we increase security funding for nonprofit institutions.
All of the above. I'm going to. Right. So I think that's good. I'm not sure that's enough.
What?
I'm actually going to give a shear in different, not an MG, a different situation. What I'm going to say, I'll throw out this question. Should Hatzalah Medical Services extend themselves to include a security service?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there anyone Hatzalah is, first of all, by one thing? So basically, in every shul, there are guys with walkie-talkies who've done a year or two training to be paramedic. Every shul. Imagine every shul we had a person who is defined as a armed guard, and who's allowed to have weaponry and training. She says not. There's no weapons.
In other words,
CSS is a fantastic institution where you have a much lower threat level. I'll just show you a little sentiment. Do you know how it all started? 1964, in the Hasidic community of Williamsburg, one of the prominent rabbis had a heart attack. They called 911. They came. And that time, our response things were about 15, 16, 17 minutes. They came to pick up the corpse. And the bottom line is that the Hasidic community, which by definition is intrinsically a little more outsiderish, intrinsically they have their own community. Why are we relying on a poorly funded, albeit well-intentioned, medical system that has a response time of 15 minutes? We're going to have dead people. We're having dead people all the time because it's not taken care of. So they organized, and they had to lobby, by the way, to get changed law because you could not have your own ambulance. They had to change the legislature to get your own. Shelly Silver, who's still not in jail, that was one of his initial things. Okay, you know. That was a good one. We'll leave it like that. Okay. You can have a private ambulance. Before that, it was illegal. You can have your own ambulance, only a governmental agency. Okay. And they got that response, and they had the Hasidim, not trained people to learn, you know, take paramedic courses, you know. And then within that year, they had a response time of 2 minutes. And you know what happened? That was one community. And then Crown Heights. Because, you know, we have people dying because we're getting, you know, EMS still even showing up at our place in 15 minutes. So then they said, we'll do what's all too. And then Flapper said, what are you left? Williamsburg and Crown Heights, you guys got some, yeah. Then there was the Flatbush. And then community by community, there are up to 30 communities in the New York area, and then 60 countries worldwide. The recognition that we, the Jewish people, cannot rely upon, we cannot export our medical emergency needs to the state, because for whatever reason, not anti-Semitic, their funding orientation does not demand that they get their citizens taken care of within 2 minutes. The Guinness Book of World Records of the most quickest response time of any ambulance service in the world is that's all. 2.5 minutes. Now, ironically, EMS has got it down. They're down to 7-8 minutes. Better than 15, okay? Whatever. So I'm gonna bring a shear, which is not the topic of tonight, a different setting, a full post on should Hatzolah extend to a security part.
So this is
the same thing as before. Yeah. Every shul.
Much worse, but there was that Israeli IDF guy. There was a
guy. Yeah, luckily, randomly.
Right, you were an Israeli IDF, right? You were
trained. Yes, he had to be trained. Yes, I'm okay. Correct. So I'm
not having a gun.
No, correct.
Even if you.
No, it was worse. Having a gun is terrible.
And all this stuff is not being trained as a police officer
correct.
Or in the
correct. I'm not so I agree with Stephanie 1000%. But we have to have, just like we have Jews in our community who invest a year or two of training to become paramedics in addition to becoming accountants. And if you go to every shul from shul, you have some dude with a thing.
Yeah.
Imagine if you had people who took the requisite amount of time to train themselves and to be licensed, and to be a whole thing. We're not talking about cowboys and Indians here. It's not about, we need a bunch of ramble. We do not need that, because that causes more harm than good. But my point being is that we might be at the situation where we have to now, in addition to our Hatzalah needs, extend that to not just medical attention, but to security attention, that we have our own armed and trained guards in every shul thing. And they knocked the people out. They did good. So, all right, I'm not a security specialist, because I'm going to move from the terror perspective, but I'm just saying, I'm just flow that as an interesting idea. I don't think the Jewish community is ready to hear that yet, but I think it's something that has to be considered.
Why aren't they ready to hear this?
Because it's a big break from the, because it comes to the same thing. I want to be American. And if I'm American, American,
believe it. Europe, we don't have armed guards.
I don't think it's such a big break that as of last, just to get in the weeds a little,
please.
As of last year, I think before Pittsburgh, there were 17 communities across, Jewish communities across the country that had Jewish community security directors, right? Because their job was to protect all synagogues, all denominations, agencies, synagogues, et cetera. That number over the last year has increased to, I think, 41 and counting, and it's moving literally the map of the, I know this person is doing 640, but the map of the United States, every Jewish community is being included as part of a regional security plan.
100%. That's vital and necessary.
That includes training, and it includes guards, and includes also the security apparatus. And it's a little more complicated, but I think that there's more of a will, but I feel very strongly it has to be done in a responsible and not just we're training people in self-defense and then being you're going to defend us.
No, so in the same way that Hatzalah takes the issue of medical thing, they have to get certified. Right. In the same way, that might have to be extended to the realm of security. And actually, in our CSS or Shomer or different organizations that were dealing with a lower level kind of threat, a guy shows up to your shul with an AR-15, which is a brutal instrument, by the way, a weapon. Because when a bullet hits your body, it destroys all the tissue. It's not like it goes right through like a .22. It literally will rupture your organs. Okay. Anyways, so on that note, let me lift up the conversation from that went a little dark there. My point being is like this. The takeaway for tonight is, in 60 seconds or less, is that Herzl, because of the encounter with the Dreyfus experience, had an epiphany that the relying upon the non-Jew for Jewish survival and security is fancy. And his Tshuva move, and of course it's very Jewish and religious because he went to a biblical solution, which is to have a Jewish state, albeit a religious state, was the solution. Similarly, the Jews in Egypt were hoping that they could work within the system of Egypt, and the new Paro will be support their side and recognize the injustice of the slavery. They recognized that was a false Messiah. He was a false, and they were Mispalel, and then God remembered the covenant and dispatched Moshe to rescue them. But the key thing is that there is always sorrow, catastrophe, Tshuva, an epiphany, and then solution, and then tefillah as part of your solution to get out. Yes,
Ivan. So about the Jews secured by non-Jews.
Yeah.
In past, 2 years ago, there were a lot of anti-Semitic
attacks.
Threats. And the government decided to make most of the shoes protected by the army.
Yeah.
And what positive thing that happened, the jujitsu, as the guy said, is that a lot of Jewish moms brought food to the soldiers and all these kind of things. And a lot of military in France were not coming from big cities and never heard of Jews and got bad attacks towards them. And after protecting the shul for a few months, the opinion that they got was much better. So
increased the sense of Jew loving among the military. Chalon. The Kogel and Chalon, the weaponry. All right, guys, have a great night.